This weekend starts right after this. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Stadiums as anchors. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us, and here's what's coming up this hour.
Sports arenas are no longer being constructed as standalone buildings. Now they're being designed as part of bigger real estate projects. Find out where.
There's an overlooked danger lurking in our high schools. Shootings that occur outside of regular hours, like at football games.
New trend in dining, high-end restaurants with a liquor license that allow you to bring your own wine.
And now high school wrestling has gotten a jolt of enthusiasm from girls.
I think the key move was more states starting to add state tournaments, separate state tournaments for girls wrestling. And what this did was essentially signal to girls that they could wrestle against other girls instead of having to wrestle against boys, which is what they've been doing for decades at the high school level if they wanted to wrestle.
Rachel Bachman at the Wall Street Journal on girls wrestling. At many high schools, an intensive focus on security during classroom hours has failed to carry over to after-school activities. That has left events without basic prevention measures and students and officials without plans for how to respond. Since January of 2013, there have been credible reports of gunfire at or around at least 108 school sporting events across the country, according to a New York Times review of incidents, many of which were tracked in the Naval Postgraduate School database. More from Times reporter Mitch Smith. He's here with an in-depth look at the issue. Mitch, what are we seeing?
What we see is that this school year, at a rate of about once a week, at school athletic events in particular, we've seen gunfire affect those events, and people have been killed, innocent bystanders have been killed, games canceled, entire communities traumatized, and it's sort of this pattern, this epidemic, if you will, that's playing out all the time, but the dots have not been connected nationally.
Wow. All right. So you mentioned, too, a lot of prep and training happens for teachers, faculty, staff, and others for during the school hours. Is that going to change now? Say, given your story or some of these stats that have come out for the after school hours?
Well, one thing that's interesting is, there hasn't been a concerted national effort to beef up security and at these after-school events. There are resources out there for school districts or for local law enforcement officials to start to do that. There's a best practices guide that's referenced in the story. There are experts who have tips, some of them kind of straightforward, some of them kind of expensive, which is perhaps why they haven't all been implemented, that can, if not eliminate the risk, certainly mitigate it, and at the very least, maybe a metal detector, for instance, prevents someone from carrying a gun into a stadium.
Wow. Give an example or two, Mitch, of, say, what has happened at one of our high school football games as of late.
Sure. So in Mobile, Alabama, this August, one of the first games of the year, right after the game had ended, someone began shooting in the stadium concourse, and 9 people were hit. Thankfully, no one died, but 9 people, bystanders, people who were spending their Friday night out in their community watching a football game, were shot. I spoke to one 18-year-old who had just graduated from one of the schools I was playing that night, and he was hit in both legs. He's walking. He looks fine, but it's changed his life. He's nervous out in public. He doesn't want to go to sports games anymore. He's not feeling 100%, and it's those. And then you certainly have other incidents. You had an 8-year-old girl killed in St. Louis after a game there. You had a young boy killed in New Jersey. And so just across the country, you're seeing these play out, and during football season in particular, on a pretty much weekly basis somewhere in America.
Wow. We're speaking with Mitch Smith, national reporter at the New York Times covering the Midwest, and he's written a piece about after-school shootings. So this one in Mobile, Alabama, for example, was it a dispute that materialized perhaps spur of the moment with somebody who happened to have a gun, or was something like this planned to happen at a high school athletic event?
Police believe in the Mobile case in particular, as well as in the vast majority of these, that it was not some well thought out in advance plot where someone had planned to do this. It was many of these, in the police version of the Mobile incident included, is someone was in a dispute, kind of a teenage argument. It escalated, and someone had a gun on them, and then the shooting began.
Wow. So what are you hearing about what happens next? Some of these schools, I would imagine, are implementing kind of reactive measures, right? You mentioned metal detectors, for example.
That's right. And so what you see frequently is that after a tragedy in a given community or at a given school, you see steps being implemented where the next game there's metal detectors or more police officers. In Mobile, for instance, they bought metal detectors a few days after the shooting there, and they instituted a clear bag policy similar to what you may encounter if you go to an NFL game or a college football game, where you can't, if you're going to bring in a purse or something, it has to be transparent, just so it's easier for security personnel to know what's going into the stadium and what people have on them. But in many cases, this is happening on a reactionary basis. After something terrible happens, then the rethinking of the security plan occurs.
Yeah. Wow. How long has this been going on, by the way, at what most of us would call some sort of alarming rate?
Well, so good data is challenging the farther you go back. But we used a Naval Postgraduate School database, which is believed to be kind of the most comprehensive in the country of gunfire on school property, along with our own reporting. And since the start of 2013, we found more than 19 people killed, more than 100 wounded in these sorts of events. And so this has been going on for a very, very long time, but it's certainly at least the last several years has been happening with really alarming regularity.
Thanks, Mitch. Mitch Smith, national reporter at the New York Times. It is 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business, but you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for spending time with us. Professional sports stadiums and arenas used to be built as standalone venues, like in the middle of a parking lot. But in a push to expand beyond game day, teams are increasingly building them as anchors for larger real estate projects. It's a story by Kendall Baker, sports editor at Axios. Kendall, what's happening?
This is a pretty big trend that's been happening for a decade, maybe even a little bit longer than that. And really, you know, in simple terms, I'd say even more simple terms than that, is that it appears that stadiums are just being built, I guess, not more responsibly, I don't know if that's the right way, but with more thought, and not simply as, you know, you think of stadiums of the past, kind of plop down in the middle of a parking lot,
yeah,
but used more as kind of an anchor for a larger real estate development. And as the late David Stern said, in a great quote, it's just, you're kind of just seeing more entrepreneurial use of ownership, right? Like the franchise is a media company, it's a digital company, it holds a key to a demographic, and it's also an epicenter for real estate development. So it's just, you know, it's again, not, I don't know if responsible is the right word, but it's just maybe more smart, more entrepreneurial.
All right, so give a couple examples here of what you profiled, like San Francisco.
Yeah, so the Chase Center, which is where the Warriors are playing, and unfortunately opened at not the best time for them, when they're literally one of the worst teams in the league. But the real estate and the stadium itself is pretty cool. I've actually been down there. And so it's, you know, a $1.4 billion project, and you think, okay, yep, nice, huge stadium. But really what it is a large plot of land with the Chase Center where the Warriors are playing. They're also landlords to Uber. I think Uber's office space is like 580,000 square feet or something. And there's also 29 restaurants and retail spaces that they also lease out to. And so you're looking at a team that's now making a ton of money on things like rent, retail sales, things like that. And that money is not shared with the NBA or with the players. That's just, you know, straight revenue for the franchise. So it's just kind of a whole different way of doing business. And as more teams begin to do this, the economics change, and then you also have the impact on the city itself.
Yeah. We're speaking with Kendall Baker, sports editor at Axios. He's written a piece entitled Stadiums Are the New Department Stores. So it doesn't have to be a high-end or large, sprawling city like San Francisco. You referenced Green Bay, Wisconsin, doing something similar.
Yeah, Green Bay is an interesting case. They've actually built an entire title town district that has everything from hotels to three-bedroom homes. They partner with Microsoft to build some labs, high-tech labs, and studio space and stuff like that. So that's a whole other specific example of a team, again, looking at their stadium as an anchor for something greater than that, as opposed to simply a destination, for people to come watch a football game and go home.
You know, I'll reference it because I've been there, but what fascinates me about what's happening in Dallas is that what the Cowboys have done is not even necessarily tied to AT&T Stadium in Arlington, right? They've got this whole campus and almost city within a city in Frisco.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's where their practice facility is and team headquarters. So, yeah, it's interesting. You know, they have obviously Jerry World, and that's a whole destination in and of itself. And now they have this whole other thing that's almost like an adult, like, camp. They're building a 17-story apartment tower. So, yeah, let's go live there. You're a huge Cowboys fan. Now it's all of a sudden you're surrounded by even more Cowboys stuff. I'm sure they'll build up a whole kind of neighborhood there with shopping and all that. So, yeah, it's really kind of, popping up these little neighborhoods with like a football theme, and that's really kind of appealing to some people, I think.
Yeah. Finish up with what's next, Kendall.
Well, I think what I'm watching is first of all, as I mentioned as an example, but I think it's also kind of a what's next is Hollywood Park, which is being built in L.A. where the Rams and Chargers will play, I think is probably going to be the most extreme example of this just because of the sheer scale of it. I mean, it's a $10 billion complex. It's huge. If you look at a bird's-eye view, aerial view, the stadium itself, which is kind of what anchors it again, is like one small part of it. There's just massive space for parks. There's condos. I think they have 300 hotel rooms. They have, like, tons of retail space. So that's the project I'm watching. And I believe that's supposed to open this year.
Thanks, Kendall. Kendall Baker, sports editor at Axios. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Every year, we make resolutions. Eat healthier, get to the gym, get your finances in order. This year, make a resolution you can actually keep. Earn more money. The Wealthfront Cash Account makes it effortless to earn more on your savings so you can be proud of your financial decisions in 2020. With the Wealthfront Cash Account, you earn more interest on your money. They have one of the highest interest rates in the market at 1.82% annual percentage yield. That's 18 times more interest than the national average of 0.1%. With Wealthfront, you can save, plan, invest, and get financial advice all in one place. Right now, you could sign up for the Wealthfront Cash Account in less than 5 minutes by visiting wealthfront.com/Gordon. Go to wealthfront.com/Gordon and start earning 18 times more interest on all your savings. That's wealthfront.com/Gordon. Wealthfront is not a bank. Cash account is offered by Wealthfront Brokerage, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Wealthfront conveys funds to partner banks who accept and maintain deposits, provide the interest rate, and provide FDIC insurance. The APY is subject to change.
Glad you could be with us this winter. More than half of U.S. states will have a high school wrestling tournament for girls, either an official one, a pilot test, or even one run by a coaches association. As this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka found out, girls wrestling is now more popular than high school gymnastics.
High school wrestling was fading, but then came the girls. As Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal tells us, a rise in girls' state tournaments has driven participation in wrestling, which is now more popular than high school gymnastics. Rachel, what has changed here?
Well, I think the key
move was more states starting to add state tournaments, separate state tournaments for girls wrestling. And what this did was essentially signal to girls that they could wrestle against other girls instead of having to wrestle against boys, which is what they've been doing for decades at the high school level if they wanted to wrestle.
When there weren't girls' tournaments, how many girls were wrestling and how did that work against the boys?
You know, for years, there really were just a few thousand nationwide, and sometimes less than that, you know, maybe a handful in each state. And, you know, generally at the lower weight classes, girls could often hold their own. But, of course, as you get older and bigger, boys tend to be bigger than girls, and this did not always go very well for the girls. So, you know, even the strength issue aside, you know, it's awkward when you're a teenager to wrestle against boys if you're a girl. I mean, there, you know, a lot of people I talked to said there's just no getting around that. And so a lot of girls just really weren't interested in doing that. And so having separate girls' state tournaments and increasingly separate girls' teams really spurred more participation.
Rachel, your story talks about the number of wrestlers going down for boys. Any reason why?
You know, this is really a larger trend across high school sports. The participation numbers really are leveling off, and I think it's a complicated question for all kinds of reasons. There are some sports that are increasing, like lacrosse, and in some cases soccer, and that's because in some cases boys are leaving football or other sports that are perceived to be more dangerous. So some of it is shifting, but generally speaking, you know, some kids are doing other things. They're maybe playing video games, not going out for sports. For some kids, sports, especially at the high school level, are prohibitively expensive. So it's a complicated question. I think wrestling was sort of caught up in those larger nationwide trends. And it wasn't a plummet. It was just sort of a gradual sort of diminishment over time of participation.
We're speaking with Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Rachel, let's get back to the girls' side of things. Who is behind the push, and what states have done well in promoting girls' wrestling?
Well, that's a great question. A couple of groups. One is one called Wrestle Like a Girl, and they've done a lot of work in trying to push states to adopt state tournaments. And also USA Wrestling, which, you know, has advocated for girls, but maybe not as strongly in the past as it is now. Now I think it sees the huge potential for girls to add to the sport, and really I think sees girls and women as a big part of its future. And as in terms of the states, you know, Hawaii and Texas were the first states to have separate state tournaments for girls wrestling, and so they really were the pioneers in this. And other states have come more recently. As I write in the beginning of the story, Missouri just added a state tournament for girls last year and saw this huge jump in participation when it did. So the states that are kind of making the leap and hoping that the girls will follow, in many cases, are finding that that's true.
That is this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal sports reporter Rachel Bachman. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. Investing strategy during geopolitical turmoil. Also, why high-end restaurants already with a liquor license are embracing BYOB. And how partisan division casts a shadow on baby naming. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. What do the next 10 years look like for the automotive industry? Cars.com has put together a list of trends it's predicting. We're joined now by Joe Weisenfelder, executive editor at Cars.com. Joe, what's in the crystal ball?
Well, one of the big ones that I think people are less aware of is that cars are becoming updatable. Similar to the way your smartphone hardware, it will be around for 2 or 3 years, but the way it works will always be changing and improving. Same for your computer. Now cars will be the same. I mean, Tesla has had this for a while. They were the first with wireless updates that not only changed how the dashboard, you know, the touchscreen operates, but really any aspect of the car that's controlled by computer code. And nowadays, that's a lot. And it really extends to important features, not just, you know, fun stuff. You know, Tesla always adds games and Easter eggs. We're talking about how safety features operate, like collision avoidance systems. And, you know, a few years ago, thanks to computers, we all had to learn the word algorithm. Well, algorithms run all this stuff, and algorithms improve with time. And if you bought a car 5 or 6 years ago that wasn't a Tesla, that had one of these features, that's what you got, and you're kind of frozen in time. With an updatable car, that's not the case. It can always improve. And now other manufacturers have gotten involved, including BMW with the X5 and the 3 Series, and GM as well with the Cadillac CT5 sedan. The upcoming Chevy Corvette is on a platform that's updatable, along with the redesigned Tahoe and Suburban. Ford, the Mustang Mach-E,
right,
which is their electric car in a year, that's going to be updatable. So this is spreading, and it's a really important feature that I think is certainly going to be worth what's sure to be added cost.
I was just going to say, is an updatable car necessarily more expensive?
Well, it's certainly more expensive. I don't know how it's going to look to the consumer, but this is one of the things that we've been looking at for many years now, which is the increasing price of vehicles, partly because of technology, but also because of the move toward SUVs, which cost more. That actually led us to one of our other, you know, defining predictions and notations about the coming decade, which is an affordability crisis. We're boldly calling it an affordability crisis based on long loan terms. 7 years, which leads people in some cases to pay more for the car than they would have otherwise.
Yeah.
A lot of people carrying debt from one car loan to the next when maybe they should have, you know, considered a more affordable car to begin with, or
right,
certified pre-owned. So those that's kind of the backdrop against which we look at the other things that are going to define the coming decade, which are electric vehicles and autonomy. Which are, again, going to add cost. And sometimes it's hard to square these things. And that's you know, those are the other things that we're keeping our eyes on. And the cost is not a small part of it. The test vehicles I've seen have trunks full of computers. There's a lot of computing power in there, and that's expensive. A lot of sensors on them, which have come down from, I kid you not, six and five figures to now, I think, just maybe four, maybe $5,000 a piece. I mean, this is what we're talking about.
Thanks, Joe. Joe Weisenfelder, executive editor at cars.com. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. It's a new year, the perfect opportunity to take your business to the next level by hiring the right people. But finding qualified candidates can be challenging. ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon makes it easy. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter is so effective, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Again, ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. Turmoil like what we've seen recently in the Middle East can be stomach-flipping times for professional investors, but should it be that way for little guys like us? When there are simmering tensions between, say, the U.S. and Iran. Strategies to consider from personal finance expert Jonathan Clements, founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, help us out.
So when people see something like we're seeing in the Middle East right now, this escalating tension between the United States and Iran, they tend to get fearful, and obviously so. You know, we're talking about a potential escalation of this conflict between the two countries, and that's a scary thing. But as an investor, the question you really need to ask yourself is, what's going to be the impact on corporate earnings? I know when we're thinking about, you know, the tragedy of some sort of conflict, that may seem like a rather sort of amoral question to ask, but as investors, that's what happens, what matters. I mean, if this conflict led to reduced corporate earnings, then the stock market would fall. If it doesn't affect corporate earnings, which I believe is the case, then as an investor, it's immaterial. I mean, let's think about what's happened so far. Since the beginning of the year, we've seen a couple of dollar rise in the price of oil. That's tiny compared to what happened in 2019. In 2019, the price of oil went up $15. So we're unlikely to see a slowing of the economy because of the increase in oil prices. Meanwhile, because people have flocked to treasury bonds, interest rates have come down, so that actually alleviates some of the burden on American companies and American consumers. So overall, the impact on the economy should be little or nothing, and hence the impact on corporate earnings should be little or nothing.
So can these tensions then overseas, from an investor standpoint, be just geography specific? Like, you know, when we always deal with Iran or Iraq, we seem to talk about the price of oil.
Right. So oil is clearly the key threat to the U.S. economy, but we haven't seen much impact on the price of oil. The only other thing that could happen, and, you know, we go back to 9/11, is the impact on consumer psyche. So back at 9/11, you know, we got a slowing of the economy because, you know, people were terrified and they stopped buying. And as a consequence, the U.S. economy slowed dramatically. I don't think we're going to see that happen this time around. I think we'll look back a couple of months from now and say, you know, that was just a blip and there was really no impact on the economy. And even if there was, as an investor, you know, you cannot forecast what is going to happen in the months ahead, either in this conflict or in the stock market generally. So instead of thinking about performance, what we should think about is risk. And every investor should say to themselves, not just now, but all the time, is there money in the stock market that I will need to spend within the next 5 years? And if there is, you should be getting out of the stock market with that money. If you have a time horizon that's longer than 5 years, carry on.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com, and we're talking about what investors should consider during times of overseas tension, like what we're seeing right now in the Middle East. This seems to be one of those times, too, where every statement released by an official government person really gets combed through for detail by investors, right? Like, is this the end of things, or is this another escalation?
And I think at this point, it's important to think about why small investors, everyday investors, the people whom I write for, have a huge advantage over professional money managers. As a small investor, you don't have to worry about whether your portfolio is down a little bit this month or next month. You're investing for the decades to come. By contrast, if you're a professional money manager, you need to be really concerned about your performance over the next 12 months, because that is how you're going to be assessed, and that is what your pay is going to be based on. So performance over the next 12 months matters hugely to professional money managers. It matters almost not at all to everyday investors. So if you're an everyday investor, I'd say to you, use this to your advantage. You be the long-term investor, because the typical Wall Street pro, he or she isn't going to be.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert at HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. In an effort to woo deep-pocketed, wine-loving guests, some high-end restaurants are letting diners bring their own bottles to pair with tasting menus. Restaurants say the move helps establishments stand out and build a loyal following. Diners get to show off their expertise, craft their own selections, and avoid the restaurant's alcohol markup. It's a story by Alina Dizek, contributor at The Wall Street Journal. Alina, what's trending?
So these higher-end restaurants offer tasting menus but allow diners to actually bring their own bottles of wine to create a pairing of sorts. So people are bringing wine for the first course, wine for the dessert, and everything in between.
All right, so back up just a second. A tasting menu does not mean every Friday and Saturday night, or tasting menus just on certain days? Is that what this refers to?
Some restaurants offer tasting menus on certain days, but others offer them for the entire week. So you can have 10 or 11 courses in a two-hour time span, for instance.
Oh, wow. Okay. So who's doing what? Explain some of these restaurants that you talk to in some of these big cities like Chicago and New York, Philly.
So some of the restaurants I spoke to, they allow people to bring as much wine as they want without a corkage fee within reason. And so that means for them, they'll bring in a sparkling wine, then they'll start off with another white, a red, and a dessert wine to finish the meal. So it really becomes kind of this progression of different wines as they taste the different courses.
What I find is interesting is that some of these wines that are allowing you to bring your own already serve alcohol, right? Why aren't they peddling their own stuff? There's a great markup on alcohol.
So some of the places that serve their own alcohol are actually using this as a marketing strategy to get people in during hours where they may not be busy. For instance, a restaurant in New York offers this after 8 p.m. on some weekdays.
Okay, and then they drop the corkage fee?
Exactly. So some of the restaurants drop the corkage fee at certain times to get the diners in, for instance, at night or during less busier weekdays. During weekdays that aren't as busy, people can come in and not pay the corkage but bring their own wine.
Wow. We're speaking with Alina Dizek, contributor to the Wall Street Journal. She's got an interesting story entitled "Your Tasting Menu is BYOB. Prepare to lug half a crate of wine." Well, there was a restaurant, too, that went so far as to basically coordinate with you in advance, right? Maybe a couple of them do, like drop your wine the day off before so they can decant it, things like that. That's pretty good service.
Yeah, some of the restaurants in Chicago actually work with local wine shops and or work directly with the diners to coordinate the wines that they are bringing for the dinner. So you can drop off your wine before, so it can be decanted and ready for you for your meal the next day.
That is something. Thanks, Alina. Alina Dizek, contributor to the Wall Street Journal. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Have you realized yet the things you wanted to do in 2019 but didn't? So one goal I have for the new year is being more connected with others around me. The best way I found to maximize my time searching and filtering through information on how is through Blinkist. You see, Blinkist takes key insights from over 3,000 nonfiction books in over 27 categories and turns them into 15-minute text and audio explainers called Blinks. Blinkist helps me to understand the core ideas of each book. So when I'm commuting to and from work, Blinkist is great for me to get into a topic quickly, find new ones, and figure out which books I want to read or listen to, like How to Make People Like You in 90 Seconds or Less by Nicholas Boothman. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/morning to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/morning to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/morning. Thanks for being with us. Sociologists have written at length on the nexus between popular entertainment and baby names. But for much of the last century, politics was as important a factor in shaping new Americans' identities. The Washington Times says that explains why in 1884, when Grover Cleveland won the White House, 809 babies bore his name, up from just 127 boys the year before. 2 decades later, Woodrow Wilson helped usher in a generation of little Woodrows. Baby Jacquelines skyrocketed in 1961 with the glamorous Kennedy family taking up residence in the White House. Malia shot up the charts in 2009 with first daughter Malia Obama's arrival at the White House. The Times also says Malia's father turned an obscure name into a bit of a phenomenon. During the early campaign year of 2007, there were 5 babies named Barack. The year he took office in 2009, some 71 babies got that name. President Trump has done nothing to reverse the decline of Donald's, by the way. President Bush didn't rescue the Georges, nor did President Clinton help the name William. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.